It's time to heed the call of the wild and seek the higher calling. Higher Calling is the voice of mountain and forest wildlife and is hosted by award-winning wildlife journalist and conservationist Chester Moore. Be ready for an increase in altitude and a relentless pursuit of the creatures that dwell there.
Welcome to The Higher Calling. This is Chester Moore, and we are in the midst of the coronavirus, the COVID-19 pandemic. In our corner of the world here, what we're dealing with is wildlife, fishing, and hunting in American mountains and forest. And there is, believe it or not, a lot of implications for this situation that are happening. So fishermen are being locked out of certain areas, a lot of public lands closed. And to talk about this and also some legislation that no matter if there's a pandemic or not, it's still going to impact hunters and conservationists, we have Joe Bitar, Executive Director of the Houston Safari Club Foundation. Thanks for coming on Higher Calling.
Hey, Chester, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. I'm trying to take in all the news and digest it and see what's real and what's not real, because the world sure has changed in the last 3 weeks, hasn't it?
It has. I look at, what's the analogy? I look at consumption of news like when you open a package of Oreo cookies and you're in that first row and you're sitting there watching, binge watching something at night, and you probably shouldn't jump to the second row.
Yeah, that's kind
of... you know, consumption of news in small doses, you know, 5 Oreos are good, 20 probably not so good. So I'm trying to take in the facts from objective standpoints and data and statistics, but not come home and flip on the news every night and go to bed with the news on. It's just, I think it does your psyche good to get away from it for a little bit.
I think there is no question about that. But one thing we've got to get out there is there's so much rumor, innuendo, et cetera, about how this is impacting hunting and fishing and conservation. So we spoke on my radio show, More Outdoors, a couple of weeks ago when this first kind of happened. You were already seeing some impacts in terms of, like, you know, Canadian bear hunting and borders being shut and things like that. So what's kind of happening now?
You know, everybody's just really on standby. Let's talk about misperceptions a little bit. A lot of people are thinking, oh, national parks are closed, state parks are closed.
Yep.
There are limited areas. It's a state-by-state cases as to what's open and what's not. You know, Texas hunting and fishing season is open. They just released snapper dates for this year.
Yep.
So, you know, I encourage people to go and look state by state as to where they're going, as to what's open and what's not. But the majority of outdoor access is fully open.
Yeah, I mean, it's broken down a lot to what I'm seeing, like in the National Forest in Texas, for example. A lot of the park areas are open, but the trails are still open. I mean, the park are closed, but the trails are still open. So a lot of the facilities in some of these places are closed, but like trails and hiking and access to hunting areas are still wide open.
Right, right. And on the international level, of course, with travel bans, that's totally shut down. So what we encourage people to do is, whether they're members or affiliates of ours, we're encouraging them to stay in contact with us through social media or through our newsletters and find out what's happening and where it's happening. I've spoken with a lot of outfitters in North America and in the Southern Hemisphere, and there was an initial knee-jerk reaction to cancel hunts. And what we're doing is, you know, some of these guys are booked for the next 2 years, some are not. What they're encouraging people to do is to call them and see if they can reschedule for later in the year, as the dust settles and things start to lift a little bit. Because, you know this better than anybody, if people aren't going to places and there's no ecotourism dollars and there's no hunting dollars, the poachers move in, funds aren't available for water management, wildlife management, habitat management. So what outfitters and professional hunters are encouraging people to do is to call them and try to reschedule versus cancel. Strictly to keep the pipeline of funds flowing through for conservation efforts.
Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. I mean, if you even look here, like in America, for example, if you have a spring bear hunt booked in Canada, maybe you can change that to a fall bear hunt. There's opportunities like that.
Right, and, right, correct.
And so another thing that I thought of was like, let's take a look at bear hunting in America. Let's say, or in Canada, or let's say some of these states do have to shut down or people can't afford the outfitter fee or can't get there or whatever because of this. You're going to have in some of these areas a whole lot more bears, for example, that aren't harvested perhaps in a year. And then you may see some problems interacting with people because, as you know, hunting a lot of these larger predators is one of the means we manage them and keeping from so many human conflicts.
Right, exactly. I mean, you're seeing things in Italy and Spain and other parts of the country where, you know, people are residing and sheltering in place and wildlife is coming back in areas where they've never seen it before. It's starting to encroach on, you know, city areas. Waterways are clearing. You know, you look at some of the global maps for air pollution, and those have started to cut down a little bit as well. So you're starting to see wildlife, and human animal, human wildlife conflicts start to occur, on a more frequent basis. They're seeing animals in places they haven't seen them in a long time.
Yeah. There's a video, at a resort in Mexico with a jaguar walking right down the middle of the road there. And, you know, there's stuff like that happening. And I think this may be an opportunity. Of course, we wish we didn't have to have this opportunity. But for the sport hunting community who's conservation-minded to say, look, you know, you're not going to like that mountain lion showing up in your yard or that black bear showing up in your yard or whatever, that feral hog. And hunters, whether they get the credit or not, are definitely a barrier to that because the excess animals are not being taken out. As well as if you take areas, the ones that still have hound hunting for bears, you know, if they don't have any hounds chasing them that year, you know, they don't feel pressured. So they'll move closer into areas because typically some of these urban, suburban areas have lots of free food, for especially for animals like bears.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating thing, and I'm keeping a real close eye on that. Something else I'm keeping my eye on is the opportunistic nature of animal rights people. Got an interesting news release from the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Department that there have been robocalls that people are getting saying that hunting and fishing is closed. And I'm thinking, who would benefit from a robocall or think their agenda is being forced? I mean, I can't see someone making money off that. So I thought that has to be some kind of an animal rights activist. Because we're seeing a lot of rumors and innuendo, and I've been monitoring some of the Facebook groups of some of these animal rights groups, and they're absolutely unhinged with this thing.
I've heard and seen that as well. I've also, I'm sure you're aware of this, but in, you know, it's kind of like the perfect storm along with everything else that's going on, is that there was a recent court order in the state of New Mexico where there were petitions filed to release the contact information for all big game applicants and some categories of hunters, and that was recently handed down, and that is going to open up that's going to open up attacks on hunters by anti-hunting groups, because if they can get this at their hand on this contact information and start harassing hunters in the state of New Mexico, that sets a dangerous precedent for other states depending on their respective privacy laws.
Yeah, as someone who has received a death threat from some of these crazy people before, it's not fun. And especially as in the social media age, we've seen, matter of fact, a young lady I know received some celebrity tweeted her social media information thinking she was this other woman who had posed with a giraffe. What is it? Wasn't even her, but they look kind of alike. And because wow. This lady was a member of SCI, I believe, they saw that on her profile. They went crazy, and she received death threats for 2 months. And so this is definitely something to keep an eye on. And as we go along here, I mean, there's still, even though there's this virus, there's still these political threats out there. And I know the Houston Safari Club Foundation has created a political action committee just for that.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about the PAC.
Yeah, in the fall of last year, we've been talking about this for a couple of years now, but in the fall of last year, we officially launched in our Houston Safari Club Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit. We have a 501c4 division called Houston Safari Club without the name foundation attached to it. And attached to that is the Houston Safari Club PAC, or Political Action Committee. Mm-hmm. It was officially launched in the fall of last year. It is a federal non-connected PAC, which means basically we are raising money to support candidates that are pro-hunting, pro-conservation, pro-Second Amendment, that are running for federal seats, whether it's in the House or the Senate. Our primary focus in our first year of operation will be, of course, Texas candidates. There's a lot of districts in Texas that are coming open where incumbents are not running. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of districts in Texas, of course, just in general because of the size of the state. So there's a lot of representatives out there that we are vetting for their positions on hunting, conservation, and Second Amendment. And, of course, the only Senate race that's coming up in the state of Texas is Senator Cornyn's race. He's the longtime incumbent, mm-hmm. House Majority Whip. And so we are looking, you know, we're looking at Senator Cornyn as well. But the House races are what are of particular interest to us.
You know, and that really is such an important thing. I also deal a lot with just the zoological wildlife world and what I do. And that group of people is not nearly as politically active as the hunting community. And I've told some of the people before, if you ever want to get your act together, because the zoological world, especially the smaller zoological world, is getting hammered by animal rights groups because there's no political cohesiveness. And if it wasn't for PACs and things like this, organizations like Houston Safari Club Foundation has, I have no doubt the landscape of hunting in North America would be radically different now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we work, we work looking at these candidates. We go to D.C. every year. We talk to these people that are in office and to better understand their positions on these types of issues and so that they better understand our position on these types of issues. We work closely with the Congressional Sportsman's Caucus and the Congressional Sportsman's Foundation, which is a really cool organization. They are on the forefront. They have offices in D.C. and they are on the forefront of pushing legislation and supporting legislation that is pro-hunting, pro-conservation, pro-Second Amendment, land access, all the things that are important to the hunting community. And, it's a bipartisan group, which is really neat because mm-hmm. you see people from both sides of the aisle that hunting is in their blood. The outdoors are in their blood. It doesn't matter what their political affiliations are on a grand scale. They are there to support hunting. And so that's nice to go sit in a room with, 50, 60, 75 people at a luncheon with representatives there, House and Senate, from both sides of the aisle that are working towards this common cause. They may differ on other issues, but when it comes to hunting in the outdoors there, they're on the same side of the table. So, and that group is involved, of course, at the legislative level, also with House Committees on Natural Resources, the Agricultural Department, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and Department of the Interior as well.
Yeah, and that's all so incredibly important because it's not just like anti-hunting legislation. There's like, mining in areas they're trying to do and stuff that could mess up trout streams and all kind of different things that fall into the banner of conservation here. I want to look at a few things that are kind of on the agenda, like H.R. 3742, the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. Where does that stand right now?
Recovering America's Wildlife Act, or RAWA, as we call it, just to say a few words, that's been around for several years mm-hmm. In several iterations. It seems like every legislative session, it almost crosses the finish line and something happens. Whether it's, whether there's a budget standstill in D.C. or whether there's an election or something comes up and it just does not cross the finish line. This current piece of legislation in its current format is a bipartisan piece of legislation. It's got over 250 sponsors. Mm-hmm. It's being presented to the House leadership, or it was before the COVID-19 pandemic broke out. And basically what it does, it establishes a funding model for conservation for fish and wildlife in the 21st century. And it redirects $1.3 billion annually in revenues. And these are existing revenues. This is not new taxes. This is not solicitation of new funds. These are existing revenues going to state and fish and wildlife agencies to implement their plan. So what it's doing is it's taking money that's already out there and putting it in the right places for the states to manage their wildlife and habitat management programs on an individual basis. As you can tell, I mean, I talked to a guy yesterday with the Department of the Interior. He's basically a ghost town except the legislators sure. that are there. Mm-hmm. A lot of things have been put on hold and put aside. So unfortunately, I think all wildlife and all outdoor legislation and pretty much everything outside of economic stimulus packages and relief plans related to COVID-19 have kind of been put on the back burner for at least the next 30 days. But this piece of legislation is still alive. It's still out there. And hopefully, after all the dust settles with this, that we'll be able to go ahead and move forward. I think it's got its best chance of passing this year than it has probably in the past six years.
You know, I can see a lot of bipartisan support behind something like that. Then you have a bill like HB 5104, prohibiting the import, sale, and possession of African elephants, lions, leopards, black rhinos, white rhinos, and giraffes. And I can imagine with the Tiger King thing out there, everybody is going crazy about cats and everything. I can imagine when you get to a bill specifically like this, it probably whittles down a little bit more support. You might have to work a little bit harder to convince them on the fence.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and claim guilt for watching The Lion King. My wife and I started watching an episode and we got hooked into it. And every step of the way that I watched it, I thought, why am I watching this?
I'm telling you.
It's one of those things I couldn't get away from it. But
it's a car wreck.
We're halfway into it. We're going to go ahead and finish this thing out. You know, I'm thinking I want to watch the new season of Ozark. We got into it and we're like, okay, we put this much time into it. We're going to finish this. So I'll leave everybody's judgment of that docudrama or whatever you want to call it to their own opinions.
Sure.
But, anytime, Chester, as you know, anytime you have issues or topics that are related to bears, wolves, cats, that sort of thing, I think that there's an unfortunate and misguided perception that these animals are pettable animals from cartoons and movies over the years that are big, cuddly, huggable animals, and they're not. They're wild animals. Cats being included in Tiger King or whatever. These are wild animals.
Yes.
That are faced with their own set of circumstances, whether it be urban sprawl, human-wildlife conflict, poaching, all those sorts of factors that are threats to these species, and we're fully cognizant of that. Prohibiting the import, sale, and possession of African elephants, lions, leopards, black rhinos, white rhinos, and giraffes. That piece of legislation, HB 5104, is a wide net, if you will, to basically shut down the importation of animals that are coming in from Africa, South Africa, and these other areas. While we fully recognize that all those factors I talked about before, threats to these species, we also fully understand that probably the greatest threat to these species are the things I just mentioned before, especially poaching.
Sure.
So these game animals need to be managed like any other animal from the perspective of, we need to be able to provide habitat, water sources, dollars and funding to be able to support these species. We are against the illegal poaching and importation and transportation of these animals and their body parts. But you have to have money going in to keep these animals going, keep them alive. And that money comes primarily from people that go over from other countries that hunt them, that pay these fees, that pay these outfitters. The outfitters and the professional hunters that run these concessions, own or manage these concessions, are the ones that are keeping these animals in existence. That's it in its, you know, rawest form. So when somebody says, oh, all these animals are threatened or all these animals are endangered or whatever, however they tend to tag it, to throw a broad net across a group of animals to say, we want to totally import the sale and possession of these, is a dangerous precedent to set. So we are fully opposed to this.
We think
that animal species need to be managed by species, by animal counts, geographically, in a scientific manner, not by just saying these animals are cute, these animals, it's wrong to hunt them, and we just think it's wrong, so we want to go ahead and stop everything.
Yeah, it's a dangerous thing because of what we've talked about before on my radio program several times, the lack of money going in. You know, you make a lot of people poachers all of a sudden because there's no income and they got to eat. And, you know, it's really easy for Americans and Europeans sitting on their couch to want to manage Africa. But one of the things they don't realize about Africa in particular is it's not a country. It is a continent with many sovereign independent nations who choose to manage their wildlife as they see fit and differently. And while you have lion numbers going down, that's a lot of the lion numbers going down are in countries where lions are not hunted, for example.
Right.
Because there's not the efforts of hunters and sport hunters to fund and protect all those animals. And but I know just from someone who deals with people with animals all the time, like at our Kingdom Zoo Wildlife Center here, we do our Wishes program where we grant wildlife encounters if kids have a critical illness or loss of a parent or a sibling. And every once in a while, we'll get suckered into letting a scout group come in and visit, right? So we had some Girl Scouts come in, and I have a full-body mountain lion in here, okay? Mounted. And one of the moms, as I'm doing the presentation for the kids, I talked about, do you know what endangered species is? And then I tell them what endangered species is. And I'm talking about conservation. And the mom leans over and tells the lady next to her, you know that mountain lion he shot over there is an endangered species too. And I normally wouldn't do this, but she caught me in the right mood. I said, excuse me, what'd you say? She goes, you know those are endangered. I said, no, they're not. She goes, I guarantee you they're. I said, lady, I don't want to be disrespectful, but you picked the argument with the wrong dude today about this. And she Googled it, and it said species of least concern, right? But people get this idea. And I know it has to be a little harder to maybe get someone who's on the fence and doesn't have a hunting background, maybe behind something like protecting this, allowing these trophies to keep coming in from Africa, than it would be like restoring waterways.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the equation is not, there's a lot of scientific data out there.
Yes.
There's a lot of facts, there's a lot of figures and that sort of thing. But the simple equation is, if hunters don't pay to go on these hunts, the people that run these pieces of land, I call them pieces of land, they're very large concessions, whether they own them, they've been handed down through generations, or whether they lease them from the government. If hunters don't go and they don't spend money, the outfitter cannot pay their trackers. They cannot pay their anti-poaching units. They cannot pay anybody that helps them manage that land. Well, if that happens, the cascade of effects is less people on that land that are legally harvesting animals, that are legally hunting, opens it up for the poachers are there. Mm-hmm. So they're just looking for an opportunity. And because they're there for different situations, whether they're just bad people or because they need the money,
sure,
and they're making, you know, pennies on the dollar to go do this, to perform these dangerous poaching acts and illegal poaching acts. But let's say you had a lease in Texas and it was 1,000 acres and you bought this place and hunted it for a few years. And then you went 5 to 10 years and didn't hunt it. Guess what? If nobody ever came on that property, somebody's going to be on that property hunting it.
For sure.
They're going to go in there because you're not there. You're not monitoring it. You're not keeping it up. You're not doing those sorts of things. Now take that and multiply that times 100 on a concession in South Africa or anywhere. It opens it up to no money to pay people to manage your land, which means no crime prevention, no anti-poaching, no anything. That is the biggest threat, because while some people may think, oh, hunters are people shooting animals to put on the walls, the majority of hunters, whether they're in the U.S. or worldwide, they're hunting for meat. Now, there's a lot of people who go to South Africa, or there's some people that go to South Africa. I won't throw a big generalization out there. Some people go to South Africa that they either bring the meat back or they donate it to the ranch, or which in turn donates it to the local community. And I know some people go there and they actually seek out organizations in countries where they can harvest meat, donate it. And yeah, they may want to go back and they may want to have a mount for their wall as a memento of their trip. But these things all have a cascade of effects if they don't happen. So, you know, the generalization is people are going to shoot animals to put on the walls is not a true thing. And I'm preaching to the choir here with you, but
not sure, but our listeners,
from your listeners, you know, that are coming across your podcast, need to understand that, you know, I mean, a lot of us that are hunters go out to hunt for sustenance. I mean, when this thing first started happening with COVID-19 and I went to the grocery store and my wife was going to make my favorite dish for me, which is an Italian ground pork dish, and I couldn't find ground pork. I was like, you know what? This thing is real.
Yeah, for sure.
So I immediately went to our place and was lucky enough to harvest an Axis dough, and my freezer's full for the next year.
Yep.
So I don't have to worry about ground pork or ground burger or roast or whatever not being on the shelves at the grocery store. You know, toilet paper and hand sanitizer is a different story.
That's a different issue.
but you know, we can, as I like to say, adapt, improvise, overcome on that front as well. But, you know, there's a lot of misperceptions out there. And I think what is key in this whole conversation is that a couple of things. We need to be informed. We need to look at data. We need to understand the repercussions of doing or not doing certain things.
For sure.
In all aspects of life.
Mm-hmm.
But specifically in this conversation, to wildlife and habitat. And I really think that, you know, I hate to be sentimental or philosophical here, but I think we're at a time in our